Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are about to launch into a 72-hour period that, well, it saw the very foundations of U.S. domestic and foreign policy violently shifted by a single tragic event. This is the Federal News Update for Monday, December 1st, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. For you, the listener, our mission today is to provide a really comprehensive, granular record of everything that happened, executive, judicial, and legislative actions spanning November 29 through December 1st.
And what makes this period so crucial isn't just what happened, but the speed.
The speed. The sheer velocity of change. We are watching the government, in real time, successfully convert a horrific domestic crisis into the political justification for a total long-sought policy redefinition.
Specifically, permanently freezing the immigration system.
Right. While at the very same time executing this aggressive, almost maximalist pivot on the global stage regarding the war in Ukraine.
That convergence is the theme today. It's this moment where Washington, facing a very real internal security threat, decided to use that crisis to push through the most radical elements of its agenda, both at home and abroad.
And to really understand it, you have to go back to the catalyst, the event that happened on Wednesday, November 26th. It set off this whole chain reaction.
Okay, so let's unpack that. Let's start with the details of the crisis in the Capitol and the immediate total immigration overhaul that it triggered, starting on November 29th.
The event itself was a violent security incident near Farragut Square, which is, you know, just blocks from the White House.
Right, in the heart of the city.
Exactly. And this wasn't some random act of violence. It was a targeted ambush against members of the West Virginia National Guard.
And they were there under a federal mandate, right, for crime fighting and security support.
They were. So the fact that uniformed U.S. service members were targeted so close to the heart of the Capitol, that alone just created this instantaneous, combustible political environment.
And the human cost of it, that immediately became the centerpiece of the whole policy narrative that followed.
It had to. Specialist Sarah Beckstrom, just 20 years old, a military police officer, she succumbed to her injuries on Thanksgiving Day.
A tragic loss, and just amplified by the holiday.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf, 24, remains in critical condition. It's impossible to talk about the political response without first acknowledging the gravity of that attack.
Okay, so then who was the assailant?
He was identified as Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, an Afghan national. But here is where it gets incredibly complex. This is the detail the administration immediately had to navigate.
He wasn't a stranger to the U.S. government.
Not at all. He was a former operative of the CIA-backed Zero Units. These were elite Afghan paramilitary forces that the U.S. used extensively when we were there.
And this is where the timeline becomes a massive headache for the administration's, let's say, simplified narrative.
A huge headache. Lakhanwal initially entered the U.S. in September 2021. That was under Operation Allies Welcome, which was, you know, initiated by the Biden administration after the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
But, and this is the truly critical granular detail, this asylum application was formally adjudicated, and crucially, it was approved by the current Trump administration.
In April 2025.
Just 7 months ago. So that means the current vetting system, under the current leadership, certified him as non-threatening.
And that nuance is the political Achilles heel they immediately tried to cover. Instead of admitting a failure of their own vetting process back in April, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, she swiftly advanced the administration's counter-narrative.
Which was?
That Lakhanwal was likely radicalized after arriving in the U.S.
So that shifts the focus entirely.
Completely. It's no longer about whether the vetting failed to spot a past threat. It's about claiming that American soil and culture are some kind of breeding ground for radicalization. The implication is that all subsequent immigrants pose an unmitigable future security threat.
That's a huge intellectual pivot from a specific vetting failure to a systemic assimilation failure.
And that pivot is the foundation. It's what they use to justify the whole permanent pause policy shift and that inflammatory rhetoric of reverse migration. It's an argument for shutting down the whole system rather than just fixing a single administrative glitch.
Right. And while the executive branch was engineering this political story, the judicial system was moving just as fast.
With equal swiftness. On November 29th, federal prosecution was led by U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro. The charges were formally upgraded to include one count of first-degree murder, three counts of possession of a firearm during a crime of violence, and two counts of assault with intent to kill while armed.
And Attorney General Pamela Bondi used the moment to signal maximum intent.
Oh, immediately. She stated the administration would seek the death penalty.
Calling him a monster who should not have been in our country.
Bondi's statement aligns perfectly with the policy goal, you see. Use the legal system to impose the harshest possible penalty, which underlines the severity of the threat, and then use that to solidify public support for the huge policy changes they were about to roll out.
Which brings us directly to those changes, the total asylum freeze. The pressure from the top translated into this immediate sweeping executive action from DHS on November 29th. So what did that hard stop actually look like, you know, operationally inside the bureaucracy?
Well, DHS initiated a complete and indefinite cessation of asylum processing across the entire docket.
Yeah.
This wasn't a slowdown. This was a full-on bureaucratic shutdown.
A hard stop.
A hard stop. Joseph Edlow, the USCIS director, he issued internal guidance to asylum officers instructing them to, and I'm quoting here, refrain from approving, denying, or closing asylum applications.
That's profound, because that doesn't just affect new cases. It affects the whole backlog.
It affects everything, both the affirmative asylum cases, those filed voluntarily with USCIS, and the massive backlog of defensive cases inside the Department of Justice's immigration courts, which all rely on USCIS processing to move forward.
So you have thousands of people who are maybe days away from getting a decision, closure, and suddenly they're just left in indefinite limbo.
Exactly. The immediate public impact was severe. USCIS canceled all in-person decision pickups. They suspended issuing approval notices. And the official communication explicitly linked the halt to the horrific events of the shooting,
making the administrative freeze synonymous with national security.
The message is crystal clear. The system is too dangerous to operate, so we are shutting it down completely.
What's so fascinating, though, and it really speaks to the complexity of the federal government, is how this crisis measure immediately collided with other existing legal battles. I'm thinking of the annual asylum fee, the AAF.
Yes. The administration was already trying to get that AAF implemented. It was a fee mandated by the H.R. 1 reconciliation bill.
But it was being challenged in court.
Right. A federal court in Maryland, in a case called SAG 2503299, had put a temporary stay on the fee. So USCIS issued a policy alert acknowledging that stay on the fee itself, but they made it abundantly clear.
Let me guess. The fee is paused, but the processing freeze is not.
Exactly. They said, well, the fee is paused, the broader total processing freeze, the complete bureaucratic hard stop, remained fully and indefinitely in effect. So, you know, one administrative hurdle gets checked by the courts, but the existential halt to the entire asylum system just plows ahead.
So while that blanket freeze was applied system-wide, the administration also launched a really targeted strike at one specific nationality.
A very targeted strike.
Yeah.
Demonstrating the direct link to the Lochinwall incident, the Afghan admissions pipeline.
So what was in that State Department cable on November 29th?
It was draconian.
No.
And immediate. The State Department sent out an immediate cable ordering a total pause on visa issuance for all individuals traveling on Afghan passports.
And that's the mechanism that freezes the special immigrant visa pipeline, the SIV program.
It is. The SIV program is that critical, legally established pathway for our Afghan allies, interpreters, translators, support staff people who risked their lives to help the U.S. during the war.
And the reports on the ground, they signaled this wasn't just a temporary pause.
That's what makes this so severe.
Mm-hmm.
We have granular reports confirming that diplomats were instructed to physically destroy printed visas that had not yet been handed over to applicants.
Destroy them.
Shred them.
Mm-hmm.
When a government tells its diplomats to shred finalized approved documents, it's a very high-level signal that this is not a bureaucratic delay. It's an indefinite or even permanent political decision.
And President Trump confirmed this himself, didn't he? From Air Force One on December 1st.
He did. He asserted there is no time limit on this pause, and then he said, we don't want those people because many have been no good.
That is extremely powerful rhetoric. It directly ties the actions of one individual, Lochinwall, to this entire group of Afghan allies who have been waiting, some for years.
And the local and humanitarian impact is instantaneous. It's agonizing. Communities like in Orange County, California, which has a large Afghan population, are seeing hundreds of families just plunged into this indefinite uncertainty.
They've been waiting for family members to arrive, and now that process is just frozen.
Completely frozen. Officials there, like Jose Serrano from the Office of Refugee and Immigrant Services, they're just overwhelmed. People are coming to them for guidance, and there is no pathway forward. It's the immediate human cost of this high-level policy shift.
So this isn't just about border policy. It's about fundamentally reshaping who's even allowed to stay in the country, which I think leads directly to this core policy framework of reverse migration.
It does.
What does that doctrine actually entail, and how is the administration operationalizing it?
Well, the rhetoric itself really solidified between November 28th and 29th. The president was on Truth Social calling for a permanent pause and advocating for reverse migration as the core policy cure.
And that concept, it moves beyond just stopping new arrivals.
Yeah, it does. It aims to systematically reduce the existing non-citizen population. And the way they're operationalizing it is through the immediate aggressive termination of temporary protected status, or TPS, designations.
Right. And for listeners who might need a quick refresher, TPS is a humanitarian status. It's for foreign nationals who can't safely return home because of, you know, war, natural disaster, things like that.
Exactly. So terminating these statuses forces hundreds of thousands of people into a terrible choice: either leave the country or face immediate deportation.
That's the critical legal reality.
And we saw a cascade of these terminations proceed immediately. TPS for South Sudan was terminated effective January 5, 2026. Burma, or Myanmar, their TPS was also terminated effective late January 2026. A termination notice for Haiti was posted on November 26.
And the situation with Venezuela is particularly complex, isn't it? It seems to reflect a lot of the political maneuvering around these different designations.
It's the most politically charged termination. The 2023 TPS designation for Venezuela, which was granted relatively recently, was terminated immediately after a Supreme Court ruling allowed it.
But there was an older one, too.
Yes. The older 2021 designation is set to end on November 7, 2025. The dates are slightly different. But the immediate termination of the 2023 one, that sends a very clear political signal. It says that regardless of the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, the U.S. will no longer use TPS as a tool for political or humanitarian relief.
So taken together, these actions across multiple continents, it's a comprehensive unwinding of humanitarian protections, all under this new banner of reverse migration.
That's what it is.
Okay, let's step back for a second and connect this to the bigger picture. This pivot on immigration required total governmental focus. But astonishingly, at the exact same time, the administration executed an equally massive pivot on a global scale.
It's incredible when you think about it.
While they were building this iron wall domestically, they were launching an aggressive, high-stakes diplomatic offensive on the world stage about the war in Ukraine. So we are now pivoting to the global grand strategy implemented between November 30th and December 1st.
What's so fascinating here is how that maximalist crisis-driven executive power we just talked about with immigration is perfectly mirrored in foreign policy. The objective is crystal clear: terminate the Russo-Ukrainian war through a negotiated settlement. And it's all centered around what's being pushed as the U.S. 19-point plan.
And this framework is being described as the administration's final offer. Uh-huh. I need you to break down those core concessions for us, because the analysis suggests this plan is, well, highly favorable to Russia. It fundamentally shifts the entire outcome of the conflict.
The concessions signal a profound and, frankly, highly controversial strategic shift. The 19-point plan effectively prioritizes the immediate cessation of hostilities over the restoration of Ukrainian territorial integrity,
which is the exact opposite of stated U.S. policy for the last 2 years.
The complete opposite. The most significant concession is the U.S. signaling de facto recognition of Russian control over Crimea, Luhansk, and Donetsk. Now, they avoid a formal de jure legal recognition, which might trigger congressional review, but functionally, it cements Russia's territorial gains from 2014 and beyond.
And it effectively rewards aggression by just freezing the current front lines.
That is the strategic implication. The plan called for a freeze of territorial control right along the current front lines in Zaporizhia and Kherson. It basically turns the line of contact into a militarized, semi-permanent international boundary inside Ukraine.
What about NATO?
It explicitly mandates the permanent exclusion of Ukraine from NATO membership. That concedes a primary and long-standing Russian war aim. And this whole package is tied to a sequenced process for lifting Western sanctions on Russia, all contingent on them sticking to the ceasefire terms.
But wait, if the U.S. is signaling this de facto recognition of Russian control, I mean, isn't that just rewarding aggression? It violates fundamental international norms. How is Secretary Rubio even selling this to European allies who have invested so much in Kyiv?
The administration's public framing, which is what Rubio is using, is that this is the only path to saving lives and preventing a prolonged stalemate that risks escalation. They claim they're making some minor structural concessions to Kyiv in exchange for stopping the fighting.
What are those nods to Kyiv?
Well, they include allowing Ukraine's accession to the European Union. That's an attempt to decouple economic integration from security guarantees. There's also a provision that prohibits Western or NATO peacekeepers, which would likely require non-aligned forces for monitoring.
Which Russia would prefer.
Exactly. It avoids a direct NATO presence on Ukrainian soil.
So this whole aggressive diplomatic push started with that summit in Florida on November 30th. Who exactly was on the U.S. delegation?
The delegation was led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. But significantly, he was accompanied by the Special Envoy for Peace Missions, Steve Witkoff, and Jared Kushner.
The presence of Witkoff and Kushner, that signals a very specific style of diplomacy.
It does. It signals the administration's preference for personalized, transactional diplomacy, often bypassing career State Department professionals.
And the Ukrainian side, they had to bring a new team to the table after a recent shakeup.
Yes, their team was recently reshuffled after the sudden resignation of Chief of Staff Andrei Yermak. So the delegation included Rustem Umerov, who is head of the Security Council, Andrei Sibiya, the foreign minister, and Andrei Hanatov, head of the armed forces.
And the meeting was described as productive.
Officially, yes. But the goal was clearly centered on pressing for Ukrainian acceptance of this framework, which is highly favorable to Russia, before the U.S. envoys headed to Moscow.
That pressure cooker environment led directly to the Moscow mission launch on December 1st.
It did. Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner departed for Moscow, with a meeting scheduled with President Vladimir Putin on December 2nd.
And the choice of those two as envoys is not just significant, it's a profound shift in diplomatic style.
It absolutely is. Witkoff and Kushner are figures associated with personal loyalty, real estate, financial dealings, not, you know, traditional multilateral diplomacy or deep regional expertise. Their selection underscores a preference for making a deal at all costs.
Potentially sacrificing long-term strategic stability for a rapid, high-profile win.
That's the concern. And this preference for personalized transactional diplomacy has already caused deep unease among European allies. They're worried that their long-term security interests and NATO's integrity are being sidelined.
And the Kremlin's reaction seems to have confirmed that this strategy works for them.
Immediately. Russian officials, including aide Yuri Ushakov, signaled immediate and strong receptivity to the U.S. 19-point plan, while at the same time dismissing parallel proposals from European capitals as unconstructive.
So it confirms the administration's strategy. Use direct personal channels to get a quick outcome that Moscow likes and just ignore the traditional diplomatic structures.
Well, that's it.
Seeing this U.S.-Russia channel accelerate with such momentum, European leaders then immediately initiated their own diplomatic countermeasures. They must have recognized they were being cut out of the final deal.
Right, which resulted in this rapid European pivot on December 1st. President Zelensky of Ukraine, recognizing the strategic doubt cast by the U.S. framework, which, you know, effectively neutralizes NATO security guarantees, he traveled to Paris to meet with French President Emmanuel Macron.
And their focus shifted.
It shifted from supporting the U.S. plan to securing durable security guarantees from a European coalition of the willing.
So Europe is immediately moving to create a plan B for Ukraine's defense, one that's separate from U.S. participation.
It's the only viable path they see if the U.S. plan goes through. This emerging bloc, France, the U.K., Poland, the Nordic states, is actively trying to forge a security framework outside of U.S. logistics and guarantees.
But the enormous problem is their capacity, right? Can they really do it without the U.S.?
That is the massive strategic doubt. Can they truly guarantee Ukrainian security, logistically and militarily, without American participation? The consensus among defense analysts is that they face a huge uphill struggle.
And there's still friction within that European bloc itself. I'm thinking of the Berlin consultations that same day.
Deep tensions persist. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz and Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk met, supposedly, for coordination. But Poland is demanding a much harder line against Russia, refusing to cede territory. Meanwhile, Germany is focused on its enduring economic anxieties, fearing that more aid or a longer conflict risks a full recession.
So the simultaneous fracture and realignment within the Western alliance is the direct result of the U.S. just aggressively pursuing its own peace term.
That's what's happening.
Okay, we've established this theme of crisis and maximalist executive action, both in domestic immigration and global strategy. Now, let's bring the focus back inside the machinery of the federal government itself, because these pivots have massive structural and fiscal consequences for the workforce, for the budget.
This leads us directly into the forecast that was projected on December 1st, the one concerning the defense versus civilian budget divide. The Professional Services Council's latest federal market forecast, which is highly respected, it compiles input from over 400 industry experts. It paints a very stark picture.
And that picture is?
A sustained fiscal environment where legislative logjam, meaning no major budget bills get passed easily, just persists.
And this is where we see the tangible reflection of that new national security focus. Clear winners and losers for the foreseeable future.
Defense spending is the unequivocal winner. It's projected to grow steadily, rising roughly 2% annually. But the real story is the massive one-time spike to a $1 trillion budget in fiscal year 2026.
$1 trillion.
And that jump is being driven through budget reconciliation, bypassing traditional spending limits. It's the fiscal reflection of the great power competition strategy we were just talking about.
And on the other side, the civilian side. The agencies managing everything from food safety to education to immigration processing.
They are the collateral damage. Civilian agencies are facing years of flat or shrinking budgets. The forecast warns that cuts will continue to fall disproportionately on these non-defense sectors until the political balance of power changes in a future election.
So the takeaway for the contracting community is harsh.
It's harsh. The market will be tight, competitive, highly dependent on supplemental funding, and prone to crisis-driven appropriations.
And that Mike Riley quote from the report, it really encapsulates it. It's best to keep your customers close and your congressional supporters and lobbyists closer.
It suggests that any new initiatives on the non-defense side won't be funded by stable-based budgets anymore. They'll need either a crisis to unlock supplemental funds or intense lobbying for special appropriations. Stability is just gone.
And this push for defense spending also means a serious strategic realignment inside the Pentagon.
Absolutely. Resources are shifting to meet the current political priorities. So while Indo-Pacific Command remains the long-term focus, Northern Command, or NORTHCOM, and Southern Command, SOUTHCOM, are gaining disproportionate focus right now.
Which is a direct consequence of the administration's emphasis on homeland and border security.
And an expanded presence in Latin America and the Caribbean. It's a reflection of internal political priorities.
So where is the money actually going? What are the specific investment areas gaining traction in fiscal year 2026 and beyond?
The key areas are crystal clear. We're seeing a massive emphasis on the Golden Dome missile defense system, on shipbuilding, and a sustained push for munitions production capacity.
What about nuclear modernization?
Crucially, nuclear modernization, which was previously considered a toss-up in earlier forecasts because of the high cost, has now clearly moved into the winners category.
And there are new priorities emerging.
Two new high-priority areas. Contested logistics, which is the ability to resupply forces in hostile environments, and scalability, which is the ability to rapidly ramp up production capacity in a crisis.
And what's falling out of favor in this new strategic landscape? What's getting cut?
U.S. Africa Command and Central Command, which were key during the post-9/11 era, they're seeing their budgets push lower. Resources are shifting toward Europe and the Pacific, legacy systems, generalized advisory and assistance services, and significantly, the green side of sustainability initiatives are all facing cuts.
So anything deemed non-essential to direct great power military confrontation.
That's the logic.
Okay, let's talk about research and development, R&D. Is the private sector just expected to pick up the slack?
Well, R&D spending is increasing, but it's highly concentrated. It's only in areas related to advanced weapon systems, new technologies, drones, and energy dominance, which ties back to the Genesis mission we'll get to later.
But there's a catch.
There is. There's a clear and growing expectation, which was articulated in the Dombrowski analysis, that the contracting community will have to bear more of the unreimbursed R&D costs. The uncertainty is where that line gets drawn. The government handles the fighter jet, but contractors might be expected to shoulder the R&D for ancillary systems.
This whole push for massive efficiency and modernization, I'm thinking of HEGSEP's acquisition reforms, it seems to collide head-on with the administration's other drive, which is to cut the federal workforce.
A total policy contradiction.
And it's laid bare in the Space Force.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's reforms are sweeping and aggressive. More competition, faster delivery, make commercial tech the default. But the critical question, which the sources immediately raised, is whether the department has the internal human capacity to actually implement these reforms.
And the Space Force's answer, which was reported on December 1st, is a clear no.
A resounding no. Space Force leaders issued a dire warning that the deep personnel cuts mandated by the administration are actively jeopardizing the service's ability to execute Hegseth's vision. The service is already the leanest, and it has lost nearly 14% of its civilian workforce because of the OPM-mandated reduction goals.
And those cuts are concentrated right where the acquisition process actually happens.
Exactly. They're concentrated in Space Systems Command, which is the service's acquisition hub. Major General Stephen Purdy noted that the service barely has enough acquirers to do all of the work that they have now.
It's the perfect example of a policy contradiction.
It is. The political leadership demands faster, more competitive acquisition, while the civilian personnel office guts the very workforce you need to manage the competition and process the contracts. It just creates this huge administrative bottleneck.
I can only imagine the industry reaction must be incredibly cynical right now. They want to sell their new tech, but they can see this bottleneck coming a mile away.
Stakeholders are expressing what they call cautious optimism about using tools like commercial solutions opening and other transaction authority. These are mechanisms to buy tech faster, but it's paired with a healthy cynicism. They've heard these promises of reform before, and they know that without the manpower on the government side to shepherd these new contracts, the reforms are functionally inert.
Right. And moving to the broader federal personnel landscape, OPM confirmed that the White House's aggressive workforce reduction goals were actually exceeded in fiscal 2025.
The numbers are staggering. 317,000 employees left federal service in fiscal 2025. Only 68,000 were hired. So the administration's goal of four reductions for every one new hire was surpassed. The federal workforce is now down to about 2.1 million.
Which is a fundamental shrinkage of the administrative state.
By design. It's meant to reduce its capacity and its footprint.
So what's the guidance for fiscal year 2026? Just more of the same?
Yes, but with specific marching orders. Agencies are instructed to build their 2026 plans from the bottom up. They have to justify every single position based only on critical mission objectives, not just base the budget on last year's funding.
And they're targeting the top, too.
OPM specifically advised agencies to consider reducing senior executive staffing, the SES, which is the top leadership layer. The cuts are targeting all levels of the bureaucracy.
And in this push for rapid disciplinary action against, you know, perceived poor performers is also leading to adjustments in how managers are protected.
Managers have been expressing a lot of anxiety about legal or personal liability when they discipline employees under these new performance standards. So OPM tried to ease those concerns. They issued a clarification on December 1st, emphasizing the extremely limited scope for which a manager would be personally liable.
Basically telling them the agency would take the hit, not them personally.
Right. It's a strategic move to encourage managers to actually use the new disciplinary tools without fear of personal reprisal.
Now, for a really crucial human issue that was reported on December 1st, the chaos following that record-long government shutdown, specifically back pay delays.
Yeah, this is a huge problem. More than 2 weeks after the shutdown ended, some DoD civilian employees are still waiting for their back pay.
This isn't just an inconvenience. For many families, it's a financial crisis.
Absolutely. The granular example cited was at Laughlin Air Force Base in Texas, where over 150 civilians in one unit were still waiting for as much as 4 weeks of back pay. DoD maintains that all paid records have been processed, but the workers are reporting that their supervisors haven't been able to resolve the issues. It suggests a systemic administrative logjam.
And all of this financial uncertainty is happening right in the middle of open season for benefits.
The timing is terrible. The period for selecting benefits runs from November 10th to December 8th. And on December 1st, we saw announcements like Blue Cross Blue Shield offering financial rewards for healthy habits. But while good benefits are important, the immediate financial security of a paycheck is clearly the overriding issue for this workforce right now.
Okay, we've established the chaotic, high-velocity pace of the executive and administrative branches. Let's turn our attention now to the legislative and judicial branches on that same Monday, December 1st. What landmark cases were on the Supreme Court docket?
The court came back from recess to hear oral arguments in two highly consequential cases. They speak directly to the political and technological tensions of the moment. The first was Cox Communications v. Sony Music Entertainment.
This is a huge internet liability case. A lower court awarded Sony $1 billion in damages.
A staggering amount. And this case has the potential to fundamentally redefine internet privacy and how service providers operate.
So what was Cox's core defense?
Cox argued that it functions essentially as a utility provider, like a water company. They said it shouldn't be held liable for infringement unless it takes affirmative, knowing steps to encourage it. They argued that the legal knowledge standard requires more than just getting automated infringement notices.
They're just a passive carrier.
That's the argument. But Sony came back with a highly aggressive rebuttal.
Which was that Cox was willfully profiting from piracy.
Exactly. Sony argued that Cox knowingly profited from infringing subscribers by systematically refusing to implement a meaningful termination policy. They were essentially monetizing piracy by keeping high-downloading customers active, even after receiving millions of automated alerts.
And if Sony wins, the implications are massive, not just for Cox, but for every single internet user.
Huge. A ruling for Sony could mandate that internet service providers implement intrusive deep packet inspection, or DPI, technologies to constantly monitor and filter user traffic for copyrighted material.
Which would fundamentally alter the architecture of the internet.
It would create massive privacy concerns for every user by requiring the ISP to act as a constant intrusive digital surveillance arm. The stakes for anonymity and basic internet functionality are just enormous.
Wow. Okay, the second key case on the docket that day was Urias Orellana v. Bondi, and the timing of this is perfect, given the asylum freeze.
It addresses the very scope of judicial review over immigration decisions. To put it simply for you, the listener, is the final decision-maker going to be the immigration judge on the ground, or can a federal court look at the facts afresh?
So the core legal question is about deference.
It is. Must federal appeals courts defer to the Board of Immigration Appeals' factual determination of persecution? Or can they review the legal standard de novo, meaning independently, without deference?
And why does this case matter so profoundly right now, alongside that administrative asylum freeze?
Because the administration is actively seeking to deny asylum claims and expedite deportations. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of deference, which is what Attorney General Bondi's office argued, it would substantially insulate executive asylum denials from judicial reversal.
It would create a powerful judicial complement to the administrative freeze.
Exactly. It would further seal the system from oversight and dramatically reduce the effectiveness of appeals for applicants.
And the court also moved on the shadow docket that day concerning the NCUA.
That's right. The court denied the petition for certiorari before judgment from Todd Harper and Tanya Otsuka. They were the ousted Democratic members of the National Credit Union Administration Board.
They were trying to fast-track their case.
Right, alongside the major administrative power case, Trump v. Slaughter. But the denial forces them to wait for that ruling, which effectively leaves the NCUA, the regulator of all federal credit unions, under total Republican control in the meantime. It cements the administration's regulatory control through judicial timing.
Okay, let's switch to the legislative branch. The House immediately aligned itself with the administration's broader geopolitical strategy, specifically by targeting Chinese influence in U.S. education.
The House Rules Committee convened at 4:00 p.m. ET on December 1st to structure the debate for a suite of bills designed to sever ties between U.S. schools, particularly K-12, and the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP.
It's a clear move to operationalize the America First posture within the education and national security spheres.
Framing the issue as an ideological fight.
So let's detail these measures. What was the goal of H.R. 1005, the CLASS Act?
The CLASS Act stands for the Combating the Lies of Authoritarians in School Systems Act. It targets the soft power entry points. Its objective is to prohibit K-12 public schools from accepting funds from or entering into contracts with the Chinese government or the CCP.
So it's aimed squarely at things like the Confucius classrooms.
Explicitly. Which critics argue are just vehicles for Chinese propaganda and influence operations inside U.S. schools.
And H.R. 1069, the Protect Our Kids Act, that one provides the teeth by leveraging federal funds.
It goes further. It prohibits federal education funds, a massive financial lever, for any school that receives direct or indirect support from the CCP. It creates a mechanism of financial pain. There is a waiver, but the bar is impossibly high.
The contract has to be proven to benefit U.S. national security.
Which effectively forces institutions to choose Chinese funding or federal support. It ensured a decoupling.
And were there other measures in that package?
Yes. H.R. 2049, the TRACE Act, requires parental notification of any foreign funding in schools, which is about transparency. And also, H.R. 4312, the SCORE Act, was also being prepped for debate. While it seems unrelated, it aims to create a national framework for college athlete compensation, or NIL.
Name, image, and likeness.
Right. It's an attempt to preempt conflicting state laws and create a uniform, federally controlled market standard for student athletes.
Finally, let's look at the administrative state's deep, long-term structural moves, particularly in technology and research. This grand strategy is reflected in something called the Genesis Mission.
The Genesis Mission is the centerpiece of the administration's technological response to the great power competition with China. The implementation of the November 24th executive order is accelerating with what's being described as a whole-of-government effort.
And the strategic concept here is basically to nationalize and unify high-end research assets.
That's it. Combining federal scientific data sets, national lab supercomputing resources, and private AI capabilities all into one unified American science and security platform.
That sounds like a declaration of technological war. It must be demanding resources from across the entire federal apparatus.
It is explicitly designed to secure energy dominance and national security superiority over China. And the timeline reflects this wartime tempo. The Department of Energy is tasked with an immediate inventory of all computing assets within 90 days.
90 days.
And critically, an initial operating capability for at least one national challenge, meaning a specific strategic goal, is required within 270 days. This is radical acceleration of the bureaucratic timeline.
A demand for immediate centralization and deployment of powerful technological tools.
Yes.
Okay, shifting to oversight, we also saw the USPS Inspector General flagging some major operational inefficiency. This one about physical assets.
Right. The USPS IG found the agency missed opportunities to save nearly $15 million a year just by failing to collect accurate space utilization data for more than 60% of its massive portfolio of 34,000 properties.
It just highlights this persistent, mundane issue. The massive federal bureaucracy often struggles to just manage its own physical footprint efficiently,
wasting millions in underutilized or poorly tracked space.
And there was a small glimmer of potential hope for IT modernization, which has been a consistent pain point for civilian agencies.
A very small glimmer, which really underscores the desperation. The Senate allocated $5 million for the Technology Modernization Fund, or TMF, for 2026.
That's a tiny influx after two straight years of no new funding.
And the House version, reflecting that austerity focus, included zero. So they have to compromise just to get $5 million. The key context here is that the TMF board made only one new award in all of 2025. It shows you how starved of resources IT modernization currently is.
The Government Accountability Office, the GAO, also issued a timely warning about the increasing digital surveillance of federal employees.
The GAO alerted agencies to the potential negative impacts of this. It's become more widespread with remote work and the push for efficiency. They warned of negative mental health consequences, increased stress, and the risk of inaccurate performance assessments based on flawed data.
Even while they acknowledge that monitoring can improve operational oversight,
it highlights that inherent tension between the executive's push for maximized productivity and the well-being and privacy of this diminished federal workforce.
And what's fascinating is that even as the executive branch tries to reduce its footprint and eliminate agencies, the judicial branch is occasionally pumping the brakes.
It is. A federal court issued a permanent injunction blocking the administration's plan to eliminate four small targeted agencies: the Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Minority Business and Development Agency, the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, and the Interagency Council on Homelessness.
And the court's reasoning.
The court found that the proposed cuts would fundamentally undermine their ability to perform functions that are legally required by statute. So it establishes a clear judicial boundary on the executive's power to just dissolve agencies without legislative approval.
Okay, and finally, what was crossing the federal register on December 1st, kind of finalizing these administrative shifts?
USCIS published notices regarding inflation-adjusted fee increases for fiscal year 2026, which just further raises the financial barrier for anyone seeking legal immigration or adjustment of status. It aligns perfectly with the permanent pause theme.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, the initiation of five-year sunset reviews for various trade regulations signals the administration's clear intent to continue using tariffs and trade barriers as a form of economic statecraft. It's maintaining its protectionist approach.
So to summarize the theme of this high-velocity 72-hour period,
the government successfully engineered the conversion of a tragic domestic crisis, that National Guard shooting into the core justification for implementing radical systemic policy goals.
Specifically, the total asylum freeze and the doctrine of reverse migration.
Right. This allowed the executive branch to rapidly dismantle the humanitarian immigration infrastructure. And at the same time, it pursued a maximalist, high-stakes, foreign policy shift, forcing a Ukraine peace process through personal envoys and on terms highly favorable to Russia.
This is the velocity of change in December 2025. Domestic tragedy becomes global political leverage. We are seeing a government operating under self-created conditions of perpetual crisis to achieve these profound realignments in its domestic structure.
Through aggressive workforce cuts and defense funding spikes.
And in its technological and global strategy, notably through the Genesis mission.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the administration is focusing resources almost exclusively on achieving national security, border security, and technological superiority over China. Everything else, civilian agency expertise, humanitarian protections, traditional diplomatic channels, is just being starved of funding and human capital.
So what does this all mean for the long-term effectiveness of the federal government? Given this comprehensive push for massive defense spending, the deep workforce cuts in civilian agencies that hold so much of the government's institutional memory and expertise, and the nationalization of AI research via the Genesis mission, what is the long-term cost? What's the cost in terms of bureaucratic expertise, institutional capacity, and public trust when the government operates permanently at this crisis-driven maximalist speed? And what happens when a crisis demanding civilian expertise, like a public health emergency or a massive infrastructure failure, hits a government that's been intentionally starved of that very capacity? It's a question you must keep asking as these policies take hold.